We're going to be studying from Genesis chapter 22 and chapter 23. Now, if you have a copy of the lesson, you see we've got an outline there covering the main points. Abraham offers Isaac. We'll not spend much time on the children of Nahor, but Abraham buys burial land for Sarah and himself. Sarah dies and is buried. We may look at that briefly. Primarily, we're going to be looking at chapter 22, Abraham offering Isaac, and some things about Sarah, if time will permit. So, chapter 22. So, how old was Abraham when he had his son of promise? 100. And so here now we have this strange, it seems to us, command that God makes to him beginning in chapter 22, verse 1. It came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. The King James Version, instead of tested Abraham, said God tempted Abraham. God did tempt Abraham. Some versions translate it, prove him. This version says that God tested Abraham. If you hold your finger here at chapter 22, go to James chapter 1. James chapter 1. Now, when the King James was translated, 1611, and then the version that if you're reading from it now, 1779, words had different connotations. I looked today at the word tempt in the Webster's 1828 dictionary. And one of the definitions of the word tempt in that dictionary is to incite or solicit to an evil act. That was definition number one. But in definition number five, it said in Scripture, to try, to prove, to put to trial for proof. And that very dictionary gave Genesis 22 as an example of that meaning. So remember, when you read the King James Version, you're reading a good translation, but dated translation. And we may use the word tempt today primarily in the sense of definition number one, to solicit to evil. So of those two possibilities, which is the correct one, James 1 helps us with that. In James chapter 1 and verse 13, let no man say when he's tempted, that is when he's tried, I am tempted, that is solicited to evil by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone, that is, to incite them to do what is wrong. But each one is tempted when he's carried away and enticed by his own lust. And when lust hath conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Because of the connotation of the word tempt in our language, generally, the translations have instead translated tested, proved, tried, words like that. So I mentioned that in case you're studying with someone and they raise that question, they may have a King James Version, and you can clarify the potential meanings of that word and explain why these later translations use this, and actually turn to a passage that helps you select the correct definition of that particular word. So he's not tempting Abraham to evil. enticing him to do wrong, but he's putting his faith to the test. And so, verse 2, he said, "Take now your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son. And he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. When you think about the nature of this test, there are several factors that enter in. I've listed some. You may think of others. And after I mention these, if you have some additional ones, I'd be interested in hearing them. First of all, this son that he was told to sacrifice was the son of promise that he had waited on for so many years. Back when he was 75, you remember he was told that he would have a seed. And it was not till he was 100 when Isaac was born. And so it's not like one of a dozen children. That in itself would be difficult. But it was the son of promise that he waited for so long. Furthermore, he was the son through whom the promise of the covenant would be fulfilled. That is, you'll be a great nation. You'll be given your descendants will be given this land, and through your seed all nations will be blessed. All of that was through this son. He had another son, Ishmael, through Hagar. But it's this son through whom that covenant would be fulfilled. And so if he killed him, would that jeopardize this great Abrahamic covenant? Furthermore, when you read this verse, the way that it's written, you'll say, "Take now your son, your only son." Now, we ask you a question, I think, on the lessons on the bottom. Question number one, why was he called his only son when, in fact, Abraham had another son?
The only son that he had by Sarah.
The only son that he had by Sarah. And only connotes unique. This will help us when you get to the New Testament and you read about Jesus being God's only begotten Son. He's the Son of God in a unique way. And so Isaac is not only your son, he is your unique son. And then he adds the statement, he said, "whom you love." So adding to the fact that he's the son of promise and that the promise of the covenant is fulfilled in him, he has a strong attachment to this son. He loves him dearly. And that adds to the test that he's going to be undergoing. Then you add to the fact that this God that Abraham was serving had never, ever asked for a human sacrifice. And in fact, opposed human sacrifices. And yet he's telling Abraham to sacrifice his son. You reckon Abraham thought about that? You reckon that was a seeming contradiction in his mind? And then, Abraham at this time now is over 100 years old. I don't know how old Isaac was at this time. It was interesting to me when I was trying to determine an age. Those who write commentaries were all over the board as to what his age was, which tells me we don't know. What we know about it is that he was old enough to go on a 3-day journey, verse 4, on the third day. This is not a little baby. He was old enough, it says, that Abraham laid the wood on Isaac, verse 6. He was old enough to carry the wood for the offering. So it may well be he was 16, 18, maybe in his 20s. I don't know. But let's just say he was 15. That makes Abraham 115. If he was 25, that makes Abraham 125. God says, go kill him. When Abraham was 100, he considered his body as good as dead, Romans tells us, Romans 4:19. So there's no hope of another son. Take this son and go kill him. All kind of questions could arise, couldn't it? Obstacles could stand in the way. And then there's going to be the problem. He takes Isaac. You remember when Isaac was born? Sarah named him Isaac. Laughter. Laughter of amazement. Laughter of the fulfillment of God's promise. The praise for God. Would you want to be the one to go home and tell your wife, I killed our son? What would he tell his servants? What would he tell Isaac? Look at the text. It says in verse 4, on the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, there are some of the men he would have to explain this to, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you. We'll come back to that phrase in just a moment. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took his hand, the fire and the knife, and the two of them walked together. I don't know what that three-day journey must have been like. And I certainly can't imagine what this little short journey to the destination, just the father and son, must have been like. If there was any conversation between them other than that which is recorded, how heavy the heart of Abraham must have been. And then Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. And he said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering? What would you tell your son? Well, Abraham, in his great faith, simply said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. And you know, God told him to do this, but he didn't do it that day. He didn't do it the next day. It was the third day of this journey, leaving some time for second thoughts. Will he maintain his resolve all of that time? These are just some of the factors that I thought about when he says God was testing Abraham. And what a test it was. Are there any other factors that come to your mind? Yes, Ennis?
Well, we're talking about the age of the lad, and it tells us that he asks this question. It seems like he's old enough to understand about sacrifice and how it all went, how there had to be an animal for that sacrifice.
Old enough to understand something about sacrifices. That's a good point. All right. So we have him testing his faith. And so, verse 9, they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. I just now noticed something. Oh, wait. No, I didn't. It's a fold in my Bible. I thought there was a misprint. He arranged the wood and laid Isaac on there. Don't you wish you know more about that? Yes, Don?
It shows the respect that Isaac had for his father in that state.
It shows a lot of respect. I tell you, if my dad was getting ready to put me on an altar, as a burnt offering. I don't know what I'd do. I love my dad, but I don't know what I'd do. I don't understand all that I'm reading here. Evidently, like Don said, there's great respect. Maybe it says a lot about Isaac's faith as well, about his training. But it's interesting. You know, Abraham's over 100. He's not going to force Isaac. There's no indication he did. Isaac was a willing sacrifice. And then verse 10, Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. In Abraham's mind, had he completed what God said? In his mind, he had slain his son. Turn with me to Hebrews chapter 11. Hold your finger here at our passage. But we have a New Testament commentary on this particular event in Hebrews chapter 11. And what even enhances this particular commentary is to whom it's written. Hebrews. Very familiar with this story, a treasured story to them. And what he's doing in chapter 11 is trying to encourage these Christians who are being tested. Their faith is being tested because their very choice of Christ as their high priest is being challenged. Did they make the right choice to leave behind the law, the Jewish customs, the importance of the flesh? Is this really a better choice? That's one of the key words in Hebrews. They're suffering the fact that their houses are being ransacked and things are being stolen. Some of them are actually going to prison. It's difficult. So their faith is really being tested. And so, in chapter 10, 32 through the first part of chapter 12, he's trying to encourage them to persevere. One of the ways that he does it is by citing this case of a man whom they revered and knew about, Abraham, and the test of his faith. And here in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. Did he? He didn't kill him. In his mind, the deed was done. He offered up Isaac. This says something about how God views us. He knows our will and intent. And if for some reason we're not able to accomplish what we will and intent, God still knows our hearts. But be that as it may, he offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten. Now, over there it said your only son. Here it uses the term that's used of Christ, your only begotten son. So if we understand the concept of unique, we now have that here explained for us. And so, it was he to whom it was said, in Isaac your descendant shall be called. That's the very point we made. He was the son of promise. And he was the one through whom the promise would be fulfilled, the promise of the covenant. And the Hebrew writer cites that. That this is a factor in this test. And then, he considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead. Now note the last phrase, from which he also received him back. What does that tell you about what transpired in Abraham's mind?
Was there any doubt in his mind?
Isaac, right. Isaac was dead.
Didn't get to tell him the truth.
In his mind, this is it. He was ready to perform the act. But he received him back. And there's a little phrase at the end which we'll look at in a minute as a type. God's only begotten Son also died but was raised again. All right, so look at James chapter 2. The Hebrew letter is written to Hebrew Christians. Indications are James is one maybe of the early letters and probably written to Jewish Christians by the nature of the things that are in the book. One of the problems the Jews had throughout the centuries of their history was they talked a good story, but when it came to practice, it was a different thing. We saw that when we studied the book of Jeremiah. And you'll see that in the other prophets. Well, here are Christians. They've obeyed the gospel. James chapter 2, verse 14. What use is it, my brethren, if anyone says he has faith, but he has no works? Can that faith save him? I believe in God. I trust His promises. I trust His power. I trust His wisdom. I trust His love. I trust His covenant. Do I act like it? Now look down in the text, and we have this on your lesson, verse 21. Was not Abraham, he cites the case we're studying, was not Abraham our father justified by work? When he offered up Isaac, his son, on the altar. Again, treating the act as if it actually took place. You see that faith was working with his works, and as a result of the works, faith was perfected. We've talked about how the Hebrews used the word perfect and over time in a number of classes and sermons. Does anyone recall how the Hebrews used the word perfect?
Complete, full grown.
It is complete.
To its highest level.
Brings something, whatever is being talked about, to its highest level. You want to be perfect like God is perfect in love? You love your enemy. That's the idea. The perfect law of liberty, James 1. The highest state of law is a law that gives liberty. You'll find that usage throughout the New Testament. The highest degree of faith is a faith that makes you act because you trust God. You may not have all the answers as to why God asked you to do it, how He's going to continue to fulfill His promises to you. When I was studying this, I was thinking of Jesus' statement in Matthew 6. Seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. How? I don't know. I'm not sure I want to put this check in the treasury because I don't know about my check next week or my job. I don't know about helping somebody because I don't know about what I'm going to do. You seek first the kingdom of God. I don't know if I can quit these two jobs, working all these hours. I've got to do this to feed my family. Seek first His kingdom and His righteousness. Well, preacher, what's God going to do? I don't know. The question is, do we have the faith in God? Not that there is a God. That's certainly part of it. But 11:6 of Hebrews says that He's a rewarder of those who seek Him. Do I trust Him enough to do whatever He says? And so that's what we're seeing in the case of Abraham here. So it says Isaac was a type. So I know that the resurrection of Isaac from the dead was intended to be a type. And so somebody wants to use their Bible to help me out here in this class. So isn't that aggravating when that happens? And so I know it because Hebrews 11 states it. I want to divert for just a moment about a very important rule of Bible interpretation, at least I think it is. And that is, we don't have the liberty to say something as a type and an anti-type unless we have supporting Scripture. We can't just use our imagination. The story of Isaac, for example. In fact, I went on the web just to see Isaac as a type and found places where they talked about, I don't know how many different ways, Isaac was a type. And they would cite things like, they'd say, Isaac was a son of promise and Christ was a son of promise. And he talks about the third day, verse 4, and some would try to make that parallel Christ in the tomb for 3 days. That don't work because this third day, he wasn't even dead yet. But when people want to force these types, they just find some word or phrase and try to make it fit something. And so I went through here and I thought, well, let's see what I can do with that. It says in verse 3, that Abraham took two young men with him and Isaac. So that's two young men and Isaac. Ah, there's the type of the three crosses. There's three men, three crosses. And then he split the wood for the burnt offering. There's the type of the cross. No doubt that wood had to be split somehow to make a cross. There it is. And then it says, verse 4, he saw the place from a distance. Ah, there's Golgotha. You could see it from a distance. It was on a hill. You know what all of that is, don't you? Tell me. Hogwash, that's what that is. There's no foundation for that. It sounds nice, but we don't have any foundation for that. And so, if we're going to say type and anti-type, let's find some scriptures that help us with that. And there are good men, that make that kind of, what I think, a mistake. Gospel preachers. And I've done it in the past, so I'm not excluding myself. It's just something that I just try to caution people about and try to watch myself. All right, so verse 5. It says, stay here with the donkey. I and the lad will go over there and we will worship and return to you. Normally we may read that. We may think, well, he was just trying to not tell the servants what was going to happen. In fact, one commentator suggested that. I don't think that's the case personally. I think we will return here is exactly what it says. An indication of his faith that God would raise Isaac. That's what I read in Hebrews 11. If Hebrews 11 is the commentary, then Abraham had confidence that God made this promise through Isaac. And if God said kill Isaac, God's going to do whatever necessary to fulfill that promise. And in this case, it would imply, it would necessitate that Isaac was raised from the dead. We will come again. He's going to kill him, but we will return to you. And so he goes and stretches out his hand to kill his son. And you remember that God stopped him. Verse 12, do not stretch out your hand against the lad, and do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Abraham raised his eyes and looked. Behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And of course he took that ram and offered it. And then verse 14, Abraham called the name of the place, the Lord will provide. If you have a marginal note, if you have it in the King James Version, it'll tell you out in the margin, the Hebrew, and it'll have YHWH, which is what's translated Jehovah, then J-I-R-E-H. The King James Version is literal. It just says Jehovah Jireh. It just puts Jehovah J-I-R-E-H. This version is trying to help us by telling us what that means. The Lord will provide. And most modern versions do that. I wish the translator would just put what Moses wrote. Let me figure it out. But in any case, that's what was written. And so, as it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord, it will be provided. Now, you'll note a little number by the be provided. And again, the King James, I think, says will be seen. That's what he wrote. Back up in verse 8, God will provide. There's a little marginal note on provides. We'll see. The idea is God sees, and because he sees, he provides. That's the God we serve. And that's what happened on this occasion. Interesting marking. We had suggested you do some marking here, and I don't know if you did that or not, but back up in verse 11, we have this phrase that we've been running into, the angel of the Lord. And down in verse 12, I know you fear God since you've not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Angel of the Lord is God. And then the L-O-R-D in verse 14 is capitalized, small caps, that's Jehovah. Angel of the Lord is Jehovah. Now the term Jehovah, if I understand correctly, can refer to the Father, the Son, or the Holy Spirit. But be that as it may, the angel of the Lord here is indeed the divine personage. And so then the covenant is renewed in verse 15. Remember back in chapter 17, we had the covenant. It's been renewed 12, 15, 17. Here it's renewed again. And in verse 15 through 18, that covenant is renewed. And at the end of verse 18, we see what James was talking about. Look at verse 18. In your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. So people talk about being saved by the faith of Abraham. Well, find out what kind of faith it is. It's an obedient faith. And that's what we're learning here. Okay, just a quick side point. Abraham saying, "Behold, Milcah has borne children to your brother Nahor. Uz his firstborn, and Buz his brother, Camuel the father of Aram," and these other names. "Bethuel became the father of Rebekah." And so Isaac married Rebekah. Abraham's great niece, if I've got these family things worked out right, married a family relation. Now, let me tell you why I'm diverting on this just for a moment. One of the big conundrums, isn't that a great word? Anyway, problems that people encounter in the Bible is this one. How did Cain get a wife? You know, I was surprised to see how many people's faith have fallen, been destroyed on that one question. I was doing some research on that. But back in Genesis chapter 5, you have the answer. In verse 4. Verse 3 says when he was 130 years old, Adam had Seth. He had Seth right after Cain killed Abel, didn't he? So, by the time Cain is said to have a wife, it's over 100 years that Adam had lived. And it says in verse 4, he had other sons and daughters. There'd be no problem with envisioning that Adam had a large family. Daughters from whom Cain could choose. You say, but that's marrying a family member. They did that then. Two things. One, at this time, there was no law against it. God did not have a law against it. In later generations, God did. Maybe one of the reasons is, and I'm not certain about this, but it is a factor to consider, that the reason marrying family members is not considered a good idea is because of the potential genetic problem, causing all kind of physical deformities. But that is a result of years and years and years, generations of inheriting parents' genes. We're way back in the beginning. You didn't have that genetic problem. So anyway, it just occurred to me when I was looking at chapter 22 that there was a practice that they engaged in back then that in later times they didn't. And it helped to solve what some have considered a death blow to the credibility of the Bible, and it's foolish, it doesn't. Yes, Sally?
Abraham married his sister.
Right? Good point, Sally makes. Abraham married his sister. Half sister, but family relation. Okay. Now, chapter 23, Sarah lived 127 years. And so then she passed away, and they mourned for her. And Abraham buried her in the land that he had purchased. Now, we ask you a question. I think it was on this lesson. Let me see. Number 4, how much of the land of Canaan did Abraham receive for himself as a gift from God?
None.
Zero. This land he purchased. The land promised was for his descendants. Well, if he received no land, what kept him going? That question number 5. What kept him going? Look at Hebrews chapter 11, and you'll have your answer. Hebrews chapter 11. And while we're in Hebrews, so we're also going to cover this business about Sarah. We've already seen that Abraham was not a perfect man. That is, he had faults, he had weaknesses. Sarah too. Right? Tried to implement her plan to help God along, lied on one occasion, doubted God's promise on one occasion. All right, look at Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Abraham, verse 8, when he was called, obeyed, going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. That's chapter 12. End of chapter 11 and then chapter 12. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land. He's an alien there. Foreign land. Because he's poor? No, he's wealthy. Because he's downtrodden and has no power or influence? No, he's a man of influence. Dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. 75 when he went, died 175. Live 100 years in tents. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Looking for the city. But it's not just Abraham. Keep reading. By faith, even Sarah herself, received ability to conceive and even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful. God's faithful means what? He can be trusted. We talk about faithful Christians. That's the idea. You ought to be able to be trusted to your commitments. And so, down in verse 13, all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and welcomed them from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth, they knew this earth wasn't where they're going to be getting their reward. Strangers here, exiles here. For those who say such things make it clear they're seeking a country of their own, a fatherland, a place where people share their faith, share their views, and share their priorities. My own country. If they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. We talked about that in a previous class. He could have went back. But as it is, they desire a better country that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He prepared a city for them. Yes, DeMarcus?
That's just like similar to us today, how we move about and do things throughout the world. And even people ask you, hey, what's your
Good observation. And we should find encouragement in that, strength in that. So it's not only Abraham, Sarah, far from a perfect woman, but she lived by faith in God. What an encouragement that ought to be to us as well.